I want people to remember that I truly respected their music and I wanted to play it from my heart. I want every artist I work with to always feel like I brought passion to their stage and joy and honor and respect. That means a lot to me because as an artist, I would want to feel the same way.
Everybody, welcome back to Loose Connection. I'm Chris Leonard, joined by Kyle Chernside.
So, in class today, if you didn't know, I've been teaching at Webster University as a adjunct professor for professional development too. And I always ask the students, I'm like, hey, you know, what do I need to listen to? What's new? What should I listen to? Because I kind of like to stay up on things. So I listened to the new Vultures album with Ty Dolla $ign and Kanye. Don't know what to quite think about that. It's placing in the top five of Spotify. I don't know what top five that is necessarily, but yeah, it's up there. The new Yeet album, Yeet, which I don't know how that's up there. And then I ended up putting on the new Little Yachty because our guest referred to it as Pink Floyd. And come on. I'm a Pink Floyd fan. I love Dark Side and The Wall. Like, I love all the Roger Waters stuff. And it was interesting to me because we talked about creatives.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a time in the podcast that you're going to hear we talk about, you know, where hip-hop or rap came from. You know, back in the day, the party, the DJ, the MC. It's more than that now. These artists are starting to get into more creative ideas. And you even talk about Tyler, the Creator. And,
that's right,
a lot of live bands going out. So you brought on your friend, and I listened to this album, and literally, if you took Little Yachty's voice out of this, it would be a funk Pink Floyd album. I'm dead serious. If you haven't listened to it, give it a shot, just because of the music involved with this thing. It's far cry from what rap used to be, for sure.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm sure you've heard the same thing with like Tyler and everything else you started to experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no. So I brought on my friend Tasia. We did two tours back together. I want to say around the 2009 ish era, maybe 2007, somewhere in that range. She was out touring with Music Soul Child. I was supporting the headlines on those two tours. Neo was on one of the tours and Anthony Hamilton on the other. And she was just very electric, fun bass player. She went on to do a bunch of other stuff with like Chrisette Michelle, Janelle Monáe, JID, recently Lil Yachty. And then we also talk about, she had a departure there in a little bit for a little while, and she went home and led, was like an MD and stuff at her church. Which was interesting as well because of that particular church. She was the first female, and she was also the first African-American to be in that position as well. So we kind of dig into that a little bit. And, you know,
I think we kind of pushed the envelope, Chris. We did. Like, I think we asked her questions that she wanted to answer that no one has asked her before.
That's what we try to do here.
So, guys, check out our socials. Check out our Facebook, our Instagram, our TikTok. Tell a friend. If you're enjoying Loose Connection, if you're not enjoying Loose Connection, please get a hold of us, DM us at one of those socials.
At Loose Connection Pod on just about every platform. And we look forward to hearing from you and hope you enjoy this episode. Tasia, what's the earliest remembrance you have of picking up an instrument?
Well, I was 9 and I took piano lessons for like 2 to 3 months. And my sister and I did it. I have a sister, one of my sisters a year. We're a year apart. So anyway, we took it for 3 months and then we stopped because we didn't practice enough. And then, but my first time touching a bass was 6th grade. I had to pick an elective, and I picked orchestra just on a whim. And the first day of class, the teacher was like, pick an instrument, and all the girls ran to the violins. And I was like, well, I don't want to do that. And I've been tall. I was tall early. I'm 5'10 now, but and I was like, oh, I want to play the tall violin. And my teacher was like, well, no, you don't want to play violin like the other girls. And I was like, no, I don't want to. So he's like, well, I'll let you play the bass if you're going to be serious about it. And after a week, he realized that I would be serious about it. And then he was very encouraging. But
was there some sort of
anti-streak?
was there some sort of like enthusiasm for this huge instrument too? Like, did you see it and you're like, yeah.
It was just interesting to me, this big violin. It was tall. I was tall. It was different, and none of the other girls wanted to play it, so I had to play it just because of that.
I really think kids should play piano, and I feel bad because I didn't put the piano in my kids' life. Like, we had one sitting there all the time. It was more of like a decoration than it was an instrument. Mm-hmm. But I think piano covers so many aspects: notes, treble, and bass.
Yes.
And percussive stuff as well. So rhythm. And I think that's like a huge launching pad for children. Like,
yes.
I couldn't do it. Like, I have a keyboard, my computer sitting on a keyboard right now, and I can't play it.
Looks great in the pictures.
It's good. Looks good sitting here. Thank you, Casio.
No, I mean, and I do think every child should be exposed to piano. And like, even, I mean, that's where I initially learned how to read music. You're right. Treble clef, bass clef, learning rhythms. And even if it was just 3 months for us, but that was the catalyst for me, you know.
Mm-hmm. Was it a music family?
No, I'm the only musician, especially working like professional musician in my family. My mom, I believe in high school, she played clarinet for a little bit, but she was a flaget in the band. And in order to be an auxiliary, she had to have an instrument. But that was just for, you know, a couple of years. I think my grandfather, I believe he played saxophone a little bit in high school, just, you know, but there's no, I'm the first official professional musician in my family.
That's cool. Chris, we should break that down because I think there's a cool story in that, because I was the only musician in my family too. And I felt like the black sheep because of it, because it was this weird art that I pursued, and it wasn't like a sport or an academic. Music was like, you're kind of like the standout of the family of like, oh, she's bringing the big bass in today.
Well, I know my sisters, they tease me a lot. So I started bass in middle school, and then I was tapped into a performance arts magnet program for high school for the jazz program. But in order to be in the performance arts magnet program, I had to play in all of the bands year round. So marching band and symphonic band. And I remember my band director was like, well, you already play bass, so you should just probably play bass instruments all around. I was like, I'm not playing sousaphone. Like, there's no way I'm going to. No.
I played tuba in high school. So similarly, I had to get a fine art credit. It was like, man, what am I going to do? Right. And so I go to the music teacher, and, you know, she's like, what do you want to do? And it's like, oh, I want to play drums. She's like, yeah, you and 20 other people want to play.
Everybody. Right?
She's like, tell you what. She's like, what I need is a tuba player, you know? And I was like, I don't know how to read music or play. She's like, I'll teach it. And I'm like, all right. So study hall period, like third period, I come down, you know, she like hand wrote out like, you know, the notes, like, you know, 1, 1, 2, 1, 3, like the mm-hmm. mouths or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I sat next to the Barry Sax, and it's like, I just listened to him for pitch. I played by number, and I played for a year. And the funny thing is, like, so they didn't have a tuba player for the while in the orchestra, so they didn't have a actual proper tuba. All they had was a fiberglass sousaphone for the marching, right? So that's what
a commodity.
That's what I started on.
Oh my goodness.
And then they're like, halfway through the year, like, oh, we got a tuba player. Let's go get like an upright proper brass tuba, you know? And I played on that for the rest of the remainder of the year. So I did play sousaphone and tuba for a year by number in high school.
You look like a sousaphone kind of guy.
I ended up playing alto sax. Mr. Dorsey was the band director, the jazz director, and he was like, pick an instrument. So I picked alto sax. I had to go to summer school before ninth grade so I could learn it. And I picked it up pretty quickly, and I ended up being like the first freshman section leader.
No way. Holy crazy. Yeah, that's awesome.
Because you know, like when it was time for they were opening up the auditions for section leader, and I was like, well, Mr. Dorsey, like, what are the requirements? And he said it's usually an upperclassman. And I was like, well, is that a rule? You know? And he was like, I mean, what do you say? And I was like, well, I would like to apply. You know, I don't know. I've always just had to test the boundary. So,
well, I'm sensing a theme there, given some of the other stuff that's coming in your life. So,
like, I don't know. But anyway, I was a co-section leader, so there was an upperclassman also, but I was the first freshman. I think I was the only freshman who ever went out for it. I'm like, there's no rule that I couldn't, right?
So, that's right.
And then over the winter break, he's like, I need an oboe player for symphonic band. He's like, I think you should take it home and learn it. And so I picked up oboe. So the part of the story about siblings, it's funny because my sisters were all like cheerleaders and stuff. And so I was the weird sister that was at the park under the tree. My sister likes to tease me. Like, she's like, we're so embarrassed that you're over there under the tree playing your oboe.
Hey, kids are mean. Kids are mean. And that's why I brought that up, is because the sousaphone, the bass, like, that's not even what the music kids
choose.
It's
not the cool, right?
Yeah, that's not even the cool music kids, you know, they do a sax, they do a trumpet, they do a drum.
Guitar. Like,
yeah, guitar. And so you were choosing, and then you said oboe, and I was like, oh, let's go. Like, oboe and, what is it, double bassoon?
They're double reeds, yep.
Double reed instruments, and mm-hmm. they're crazy because in early times, they were the soloist.
Right.
They were the highlight of the orchestra, right. Was the double reed. But everyone thought they were so silly. In school, you were like, oh, you play a double reed?
Sound like a duck?
Yeah. But all those old cartoons and everything that was like
mm-hmm. yep.
made for, like, I remember, I'm going to go ahead and say it, Bugs Bunny was probably the first time that I really even heard. I was like, what is that instrument?
Oh, yeah.
Like the Elmer Fudd thing, because that was like bassoon and oboe. Uh-huh. That was how they talked. That was how they communicated. And it was so interesting to me. But then I was like, when I chose my instrument, I was like, I can't play that. I can't be seen carrying that to school.
I was a dork. It's okay.
Yeah, man. Hey, all us dorks turned out okay. Let's go ahead and clear that up right now.
Yes, yes. What was the first time you got to an electric bass?
That was middle school. I started on upright bass in the sixth grade for orchestra. And then the orchestra program was dismantled for funding. And then eighth grade, so I went back to, I was a nerd. So I was taking like all these advanced academic classes. Like for an elective, like I was truly a nerd. I took like math for fun.
Dork.
Right? So, eighth grade, I remember I was summoned to the band room, and very similar to your story, Chris, we didn't have any tuba players for the marching band, and the school had an old Fender bass, and the teacher's like, I understand that you used to play bass. He's like, do you think you could play these bass parts for me for my marching band? And he was like, you could take the guitar home. If it comes back to you, will you come play these parts? I was like, sure. His name was Mr. Allen. And we had somebody would carry a little like 25 watt amp, and I would march with the marching band and play the,
wow.
And that's how I got the attention of the jazz program in high school. And so I picked up electric bass in eighth grade, and then I was not allowed to play it once I got into the jazz program. It was strictly upright only again, because Mr. Doris, you know, big band was purist. And then around 10th grade when I started gigging, that's when I started playing both, like pretty much full time.
That's how teachers sell it. They're like, hey, you can take it home. You can take that bass home.
We'll give it a try.
Yo, my friend, I have a friend. He's a bass player. He plays bass right now for PJ Morton, right? But he has this Fender, like 70, it's a 70 something Fender P bass. That he got from a school with his school was throwing it out because it didn't have any strings and they thought it was no good.
Oh my
so they're
goodness.
Like, we're going to throw this away. You can take it. So he took it and home and he didn't like it. So his dad was like, we'll go to the music store, see if we could trade it for something new. Got to the music store And the people are like, yeah, you can have whatever you want, whatever bass in here you want. So he, little kid him, is like, yes, I can get this leash. And his dad is like,
Wait a minute. Why are y'all willing
to trade, you know? So he didn't let him trade it. And they, you know, now, of course, for free, he has this, you know, it is all it needed was strings. But the school didn't know. They just thought it was broken. And they were about to throw it away. How crazy.
That's just insane.
That's a great story. Thank goodness her dad being there. Because
right.
You know he would have chosen like a Fender or one of those BC Rich Warlock basses or something. Hey, can I have the one shaped like a machine gun?
Exactly. And the music store that came up.
Were you born and raised in Atlanta then?
No, I'm from Miami, Florida.
I've heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a little town, you know. But yeah, I've been in Atlanta 14 years now. I moved right after, actually after the Music Soul Child gig was over, I moved here full time. But yeah, I've been here 14 years.
So it's crazy. Miami has such an eclectic culture.
Yes.
And I think as a bass player, that's probably really rad because you have all the Latin cultures,
yeah.
all the American cultures, and even like the Southern blues culture. Mm-hmm. How is that? Like when you first started experiencing, you started gigging in 10th grade.
Yeah.
Like what drew you to it? You probably went and saw Axe play and you were like, oh yeah, I want to do that.
Well, honestly, the program I was in, the music program, the magnet program I was in, it was part of that program. So like Mr. Dorsey would kind of book us shows around town to work for the county. And then it was there that I was seen by this local jazz musician. And he started having me come play in his band. My mom would come chaperone me because, of course, I was
too young.
And so that's kind of how I got into the gigging scene. In Miami, I was doing just a lot of like jazz stuff, a lot of older jazz musicians. That's kind of was my foray into gigging. And I didn't really understand, like I didn't have an understanding of what gigging was really. You know, it was just fun. Oh, you paid me to have fun. Like at that time, I had no understanding of touring or being a full-time musician. Like the only job I knew with music was to be a music teacher. And I knew I didn't want to be a music teacher. Like, I knew that, you know, so I didn't have an understanding that this is like something I could do for a living or as a lifestyle.
So what were the pros and cons of the old heads seeing this young girl come in and rip bass? Like how was the reception from them?
They were kind. I will give it to them. I those guys, and I don't know if it's because they were, when I say old, they were like old, like 50 plus, like they were older guys.
Like me.
So. Well, I mean, for a 16-year-old.
Oh, yeah.
I'm 40 now. I'll be 40 in March, so 50 is not old to me. But at 16, these guys were ancient, you know. And no offense.
College.
But no, you know, I was just like, oh. So they treated me pretty kindly. It wasn't until I got a little bit older and started playing with guys around my age where I started feeling like not received.
Yeah.
But those gentlemen were kind to me, and maybe because my mom was around, you know, maybe she was a buffer for that too. But yeah, it was also new and shiny to me. So everything was just exciting at that time. I remember like I went to a music store. It was Mars Music back then. And my first amp was like an Ampeg BA-115. And I was just like, wow, I have my own amp, you know, and I didn't have these schools amp anymore. And yeah.
funny story. I worked for St. Louis Music, and I was a tester for the bass amps. I'm not a bass player by any means, but I did all the Ampeg stuff here in St. Louis before everything moved to, I think, Loud or whatever bought Ampeg, and they moved most of their production away. But it was the reissue of all the cool classics, like the SVT Pro, or the SVT Classic, the 2 yeah. Pro, the 4 Pro, the preamps, the flip top. One of my friends redesigned the flip tops. And it was really cool to, I've never been an amplifier guy, but it was really cool to see the understanding of the history of Ampeg to begin with and how huge that is to bass players. Like I didn't understand that when I first started working there. I thought I was just working at a factory that built music stuff and I thought I was cool. But the history of Ampeg is so dope, and it's cool to hear bass players like get excited about that stuff. Like it's a different world than guitar and drums and stuff like that. Bass is like a very focused instrument. It really is.
How did Venus come about? And what was Venus?
So Venus was, and I hate to say it was, but we're not functioning as a band right now. Sure. But we were a band. We all actually met working for Music Soul Child. We were part of his touring band back in the day. The majority of us were. We went by another name back then. When we worked with music, we were called Anime.
Okay.
And then when that ended, and two of us, so most of the girls lived in Atlanta. Jay and I both lived in Florida, and we both moved to Atlanta at the same time. And we decided we wanted to do our own thing. And it was, we just decided, I remember we had done a small tour with music in Japan. And that's when we had started kind of talking about having a band. And we were like, well, what could our name be? And it was the whole Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus thing. And we're like, that's it. We could be Venus, you know? And so we're like, one day. And so then when Jay and I actually moved to Atlanta, I didn't believe we just decided to go ahead and do it. And so we were together. I mean, we officially broke up last year. Chase Dion was the last person to move away. She moved to Vegas officially last year, I believe. And so she's a keyboard player. In the pandemic, Jen, the guitar player, moved back to Cleveland. So that was like the start of the end. But yeah.
Well, okay. So I didn't. All right. So I knew when you and I toured together with Music Soul Child and Anthony Hamilton. And I knew that Music had this whole all female band.
Yes.
That's how you guys formed that. It wasn't like you were a band that he brought you guys along.
Met it being a part of that band and the chemistry that we formed. We just, the five of us, it was seven of us on tour, but five of us decided to move forward and, we really bonded well on tour and decided to do our own thing after that.
So did you guys not know each other before y'all came together at Music Soul Child?
No, not really. Jay and I and Jen and I, we met, so back in, I believe it was 2006, when Beyonce had her first worldwide search for women for her band. And I remember I begged my mom. I was like, I have to audition. So we drove to Atlanta to so I can audition. It was at Center Stage. Not Center Stage. That's at LA. What's the one here? It's also a C. Anyway, there's a rehearsal hall here. I was having to be in line and standing next to this girl. We just started talking. It was Jay LaToya, the drummer. So we met in line there. And then Jay was in line with her friend Natalie Reagans. It's a piano player. And Jen came to talk to Natalie. And we all just kind of met there. Clearly, none of us made the Beyonce band. Fast forward to 2008, 2007. That's when I first got called for the Music Soul Child gig when he was still in Philadelphia. And he was working with some girls in the D.C. area. And that bass player didn't work out. They flew me up to Philly to audition. I made that band, rehearsed with them. He fell out with the drummer, decided he didn't want to do the girl band thing anymore. I came back to Miami. 2008, he moved to Atlanta, decided he wanted to do the girl band thing again. He wanted to have new auditions. They called me up to come back. And they were like, do you know any girl musicians? And I was like, I know a drummer named Jay LaToya. And I know a guitar player named Jennifer Bliss. And I just remember Jen's name. Her name is not hard to, a cool name. Like, that's her government name, Jen Bliss. Like, what a name, right? And then Jay, we had mutual friends. This was us both being Floridians. And so I reached out to a friend that knew her. And anyway, so they both end up coming to the auditions. And that's how we didn't formally know. We hadn't played together. We didn't know each other as people really at all. It just got worked it all out.
Wow, that's awesome. That was a fun tour. That's funny. So you said that was like your first tour with music when I was out there with you.
My first time on the road.
That's awesome. Yeah,
it was the best time of my life. It was just that was the first time my eyes were really open to wow. There was no way when I left for tour, I was working, and my tour ended, and because music changed bands, and we went home, and I was like, there's no way I'm going back to this regular life anymore.
Hadn't even done a van tour or anything. This is we were playing theaters. This is Fox Theater. And
right.
Actually, that tour started or ended actually in St. Louis, the Fox Theater. I can't remember which. Kyle is in St. Louis. but that level of shows. So, tour buses, couple trucks. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, that's crazy.
It was crazy. Right into that. We started in like November of 2008 in rehearsals, and then like our first tour run was with Neo. We opened for Neo.
Oh, I was on that tour too. We did two tours together.
Yeah.
Jeez.
And then we did a European run. I mean, I spent my 25th birthday on stage at the O2 Arena in London. Like, I went from, you know, doing small local gigs in Miami to the O2 Arena on my 25th birthday. You know, like,
that's awesome.
We went to Japan. We went to Indonesia. We did, you know, like, so there was, I just never in, I had no understanding of that kind of life, like, before, you know. That's one thing. I mean, Miami's a cool city, but, like, the live music scene isn't, like, booming like that, you know. Like, it's maybe because they're so far south. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, there was no way I could go back to regular life.
It sounds like a whirlwind. Like, they just put a lasso around you and just drug you through the touring lifestyle, like, immediately. That's incredible. I mean, even from your enthusiasm from sixth grade and feeling all the little moments of highs, that was the one that broke you to say, I can't do anything else but this. This is what I want.
No, So the first time I ever, if I'm honest, the first time I ever pondered like touring, so it was like 2005. I was back then, I was like huge Neo Soul fan, which why working for Music Soulchild was like a dream come true, because like I was obsessed with Neo Soul. And I was in Target. I was looking for some new CDs, right? This is aging myself. Like, I was going to buy some new music. And back then, I was a huge Hidden Beach Records fan. Like, anything they put out, I was obsessed. And I saw this CD, and it had the Hidden Beach label. There was a new artist. Like, they're calling it Neo Gospel. And I was like, this looks interesting. Let me buy it. And then I got home and I started to have buyer's remorse. I'm like, what if I don't like it? I was scared to open the package. Cause you know, once you open the package, you can't return it.
It's yours.
So I was like, let me go check her out on her MySpace to see if I can hear the music before I open the CD. Here I'm aging myself again with MySpace. So I go to her MySpace page, check out the music, love the music. But at the top scrolling on her MySpace, it's like auditions for a band, for touring band. I'm holding auditions. You know, and I'm like, wait, what is this? You know, and I read the information. I was like, Mom, I have to go. And my mom's like, what are you talking about? Like, what does this mean? And I was like, I have to go audition for this. And she's like, well, if you go, you have to take your little sister because it's summer break. Like, and my mom had a cousin back then that lived in LA. And so she talked to her cousin. They let us come for a week up there for, you know, summer break. I went to audition. I made her band, you know, and I'm just like, what does this mean? Like, I made the band, and it was the first gig I never had because I made the band, and then the funding got pulled because Jill Scott released a new project. So, like, as a new artist, she couldn't afford out-of-state band. So, but that was the first time my mind was, like, open to, like, whoa, like, I could do something like that. So then fast forward to the next year, the Beyonce audition. I'm like, clearly, this is made for me. You know, and I went to audition. I didn't make that band. And so, you know, once the Music Soul Child was the first tour gig that actually stuck, you know, and after that, then I knew there's no going back. There's no going back to my desk job.
So what's the dynamic between your mother asking you if you're doing this thing and you just continually going and trying out and not giving up? Did she see your determination and she was like, oh, my girl's, she's coming back home, thank goodness? Or was she like,
I think she thought that I was gonna give it up after a while, you know. As most mothers are, they're concerned for your well-being and also want to make sure you're going to be a functioning adult and make good money. And nobody in my, like I said, don't come from a family. My mom's a nurse. She has a very practical job, you know, like she, my father was a police officer, you know, like they had very practical jobs and this lofty, you know, music. And when I was in high school, music was just supposed to help me look good on my college application so I can get scholarship, which I did. When I went to college, it was for engineering. You know, I didn't go for music. You know, I wasn't even supposed to be playing anymore. My mom wouldn't let me take my bass my first year. She's like, okay, put that away. It's time to focus on school, you know? So it's just, initially, I'm sure it didn't look like it. it made sense, you know, right. And then it's, but my parents, you know, they always, they do, you know, if you make up your mind about something, they were supportive. And, you know, like, I just believed in myself and they believe in me. So
that's good. Did you find yourself explaining what your like vision was to your parents? Like, and that's why they stuck with you and like backed you on it. Did you find yourself trying to like explain yourself and be like, I swear, like, it's going to work out.
Yes, often. It's like my, I will say like my dad was a lot more like, okay, if you're going to do it, do it. My mom was a lot more like, okay.
You always go to school to be a nurse.
Like, all right, Tasia, like, what are you doing? So when I decided to move to Atlanta, my mom was not happy. I decided to move to Atlanta. I didn't know, I moved after the gig was over and I had no context. I had nothing lined up. I just moved to Atlanta on a whim because I just felt like God said, go to Atlanta to pursue music full time. And so I did. And my mom was not initially happy with that. You know, she was like, that makes no sense. But but it's worked out. So, you know, but she's just being a mom. She's just being a concerned parent. And I was the oldest child. I'm the first to, you know, I didn't leave home. Like, I went to college in Miami still. Like, I went from Miami. I went to University of Miami. So, I never really left. And so, you know, they also, it was probably something she had to process too. Like, me actually going away for real.
How long did it take for you to feel comfortable on stage, you know, with, like, being a sold out and that level of show and audience? And did you instantly feel like I'm at home? Was that, you know, all the people out there? What was that like?
To be honest, that I did feel comfortable right away. Like, I think it was excitement, and it just felt like, I don't know. Also, big stages to me are a lot less scarier than small stages. It's small stages, like small rooms where you can like actually connect eyes with people, terrify me. Like, I don't actually want to see you. Like, but when you're at a big stage, people are far away, and you just could smile in general directions, and people think you're looking at them, but you're not. Like, you know, that's to me, and you can just feel the energy. It's a lot. It's just, and to me, it's more exciting. And the music, I mean, I remember, man, I remember I can remember it so clearly. First show with music was in Seattle. And it was just, I think, of course I was nervous, but it was more exciting. It's like Christmas Eve. Like, that's how it felt. Like, Christmas Eve to me is more fun than Christmas Day because, like, it's the anticipation. That's how it felt. I can remember, could see it so clearly in my mind. Like, I think that overrode the nerves. It was just like I can't believe this is happening, like, kind of feeling. Like, are you paying me to do this? Like, I would gladly do this for free. I mean, back then, maybe I probably was doing it.
Don't say that out loud. Don't say that out loud.
When I look back on what I was really, you know, making, you know, but I didn't know any better at the time, so...
Awesome. You know what? I revert to that too sometimes because there is a certain aspect of this thing we do where it's like, man, I could just do this for free for the exhilaration. Yeah. But and we've had a lot of discussions, Chris and I, on this and other podcasts where it's like, you can't sell yourself short because this is a talent, and it's like sometimes your ambition will outweigh the paycheck because you want that thing.
So bad, yeah.
Yeah, and you're like, I'll do it for free.
That's bit me in the butt a couple of times. But,
yeah,
you know,
for sure.
You learn. I'm a wiser.
So then you, let's see. So I got to run into you while you were out with Janelle Monáe.
Yes.
Which is funny. Like, didn't know you were going to be there. Didn't know. So, you know, I live in Philadelphia. The Democratic National Convention was in town. It was the year that Hillary was nominated. So whatever year that was, I don't remember at this point. So we did a bunch of parties in town, and Janelle Monáe was playing. We were at the Barnes Museum, which is like this like fancy art museum type
sounds
of place.
Fancy.
And the cool thing for me, like, leading up to this is that, like, I knew Janelle Monáe was playing, didn't know you were there. I had actually designed the show. I had designed the lighting, I designed everything for the show.
That's so cool.
You know, and so I was there just kind of oversee the project, and like and we're getting backline together. And at the time, Janelle Monáe had this vibe of like everything had to be white.
Yes.
Every mic stand, every amp, every instrument, like yes. everything was white. So like, Kyle, every mic stand, we had to take white E-tape and just wrap every mic stand in white E-tape, like just, or, you know, or gaff tape or whatever. Everything was white, right?
I'm sorry. Anyway. My charger came off, so excuse me for a second.
Oh, are you good?
I'm sorry. Okay, sorry.
You're good.
Okay, E-tape. Yes.
Yeah,
I think every artist goes through that white thing because looking at a stage where you have like all white cabinets, a white drum set, even like the Marley or whatever goes underneath it, there's something like, it's like elegant almost, you know what I mean? Like there's something elegant about it when they do like a color scheme like that, but it is a pain in the ass.
You're right. Elegant for the artist, pain for the crew.
But there was one thing that was not white, and that's what stuck out to me. I was like, oh shoot, I know who that is. There was these neon green strings emanating off of this white bass. And that was tasted. I was like, oh my goodness.
Yes. And I had to like, so by then I had been working with her for a few years. Cause at first I only had white strings. And then later on, she started to loosen up a little bit and they liked how the neon strings glowed. So then that's how I was able to get them to pass. But yeah, that was, and I mean, so we go back to my mom, right? So fast forward, like I was 2013 and I'd been in Atlanta for 3 years after moving to pursue music full time. And I was like, I moved to really, cause I was like, I need to go back on like touring. So 3 years go by and I'm playing around town, but I haven't been back on the road. And I was like, I remember it was December and I was like feeling like depressed. I'm like, maybe I should just like give this up. Cause like, I'm going to be 30 in next year, the following year. And I'm like, maybe this is just not for me. So earlier that year, my mom had gone to Essence Festival and she calls me from the festival. And she's like, Tasia, there's this girl on stage and she's black and white. And she has a band, and I could just totally see you on stage with her at Essence Festival. And I'm like, Mom, that's Janelle Monáe. Like, I had been a fan of Janelle since college. And I'm like, it's Janelle Monáe. I knew all those guys in her band. Like, I knew of them. They had been with her for a while. I'm like, Mom, like, I just kind of poo-poo. I'm like, Mom, that's, you know, she already has a band. It's not going to happen. No, you're going to, I can do this. So now this just shows you how my mom, you know, once I decided the life I was going to live, my mom became supportive. But anyway, she's like, no, I know you're going to work with her. I could see it so clearly. And I'm just like, yeah, Mom, whatever. So that's back in July of that year. So fast forward to December, and I'm going to quit music. And I get this call from this guy. And he's like, Tasia, like, Janelle's MD is looking for you. And I'm like, how? You know, so I get the call. I make the band. Fast forward to June or July of the next year for Essence Festival. Prince headlines Essence Festival and requests that Janelle opens for him. So just as my mom had envisioned the year prior, there I was on stage at Essence Festival in Janelle's band. So like, so it worked out. Yeah.
Chris, let's talk about that. That's something that you like to talk about, is kind of like envisioning something and it just happening.
Yeah.
From a point of like, from your lowest point of thinking that you're going to quit, but then there's a vision and like, you just get it. We've had Brandon Blackwell was the same way, you know, like where the dude just like climbed the ladder to get to Kendrick Lamar. That's what he wanted to do. So, and he got it.
Yeah. Oh. Well, but you know what? I listened to you in another episode or another podcast that you had done. And you referenced it's a who knows you type of business. Mm-hmm. And we've had some other people kind of talk about that. I can only imagine being in the band world, the musician world, especially, you know, as you're jumping around. What have you experienced in the world of being a musician on the who knows you as opposed to who you know, and kind of the difference there?
Well, yeah, I just think it boils down to really and truly like the reputation you set up for yourself. Like people are always, I feel like, consumed with like, I need to meet the who's who and I need to meet. But it doesn't matter how many contacts you have. It's like, who knows you? Like what? And like, they know you by your reputation. Like, for example, in this case with Janelle, the guy who put me in touch with his MD was somebody I subbed at a church one time when I moved to Atlanta. I didn't even remember this guy, and this is no shade to him, but I didn't remember playing at that church. Like it's just a one-time thing, you know, like, but I, like, what if I had shown up that day late, or if I hadn't learned my part, or if I had a bad attitude, because the person I replaced in Janelle's band was a killer musician. They just didn't vibe with him, you know, like personality wise. And so they needed a new bass player. Like, what if the guy, you know, when they were looking for me, the guy could have been like, oh, I met her, she's a jerk. Or, oh, I met her, she's not a good musician. Or she, you know, like I knew every musician in Janelle's band. I knew of them. That didn't help me get that gig. It was what they knew of me, you know, and it's just like, you always should be putting yourself out there in the best way possible, because like your reputation does precede you, and it's all about what people can say about you when you're not in the room. That's sometimes how you get in the room, is by who you are outside of the room. So.
Yep. A great writer once said, it's not who you think you are, it's who they think you are.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And we've been all doing this for such a long time. We notice that technical ability is a small fraction of what people look for in touring folk. And it's the be able, the hang, the get along, the be able to be conforming, learning, the drive. Like, those things are almost more than the technical ability for the long haul.
Yes. It really is. Nobody wants to be on a tour bus with someone that they hate. No one wants to go on a tour bus with someone that's smelly or that's dirty. Or
that's my feet. That's my feet. Sorry.
No,
sorry, that's my feet.
Matter, you know, people, because there's a billion, trillion super talented people on the earth, right? Nobody cuts the corner, like, corners of market on talent. Like, there's people who play circles around me. I'll be the first to tell you. You know, it's just. But there's other factors. Like, are you gonna respect the artist's music? Are you gonna have to? Can you play the part that is there and not insert your personality into it? You know, like, for example, Janelle's music, especially at that time, is very specific. Like, she and her producers had a sound, and they wanted it that way. And there was, you know, like, are you gonna respect it? Are you gonna respect the music? Are you gonna, you know, can you? Back then, we could only wear black and white.
Yep.
And sound check. On stage, it was white. You know, like, are you going to respect that? Like, are you going to?
Or just even like, so like stage presence, like she's very choreographed in her mannerisms and what she does on stage. And I know all of you guys on stage were, you know, and I don't know how much it was like, hey, move this way or whatever. But like, you almost have to show out, but not show off. Right?
Yes.
Like,
yes. Yes.
Like,
yes.
There's an art to that. To like,
yes, like, can't be distraction. Yeah.
Supporting the vibe, but not being the vibe that everyone's pulling to. Like, that's a thing. Yeah.
It's a live movie role at the end of the day too. So like, I think the look, the people. I mean, it's hard to do in like your father and your mom. You know. Nurses and stuff, like, they don't go off that, but this, it could come down to your look, it could come down to your personality that you just walk in with without saying anything. Like, and at some point it's like, almost sometimes it would feel discriminatory. You're like, oh man, they didn't like me because I had this stupid beard, or I was too old, or whatever the case may be. But it's almost like a known factor in this business, especially with musicians and a hired role. It's like, you have to fit the mold. The mold, you mold to the thing, it doesn't mold to you.
Yes. I'm glad that you said that, because just being a woman musician, that factors in a lot, has factored in a lot into the kind of gigs I get, and like what, and then being a Black woman has factored into that, and then being a full-figured person has factored into that a lot. And even being a tall person, there's been gigs I've not gotten because of my height. I've not gotten because, you know, it's like Janelle, I always have to, like, I'm going to, like, give her so much respect because, like, for the type of pop gig that it was, like, pop-level gig, like, I really felt like she just allowed me to be me. Like, I didn't have to conform. I didn't have to have a certain look as a woman bass player. Like, I didn't, you know, at the time I was the only girl musician in the band, and I just felt respected as a person and not, you know, it wasn't my look at all, you know, that. You know, later on, she ended up inviting more women into the band later, you know, in her later albums. But like
that, that time in
particular. Well, I really appreciate her. And, you know, because, you know, I just appreciated that a lot. You know, for that type of gig and that type of market. Like, I remember when I auditioned for the Beyonce gig, I was pulled aside and said I had the talent. I didn't have the look. You know, I wasn't edgy enough, or I didn't look cool enough, you know? And I'm not trying to, I'm not edgy, so. And I think, you know, especially like guitar players are supposed to be hot, you know, and I wasn't hot.
You know? I always refer back to the Robert Palmer Band, simply
resistible. Right. Yeah, I'm definitely not.
So for people that don't really think about this, being a musician in that style of pop act, it's look, it's presence, it's an equal opportunity. Is it really equal opportunity? It's funny that we have to talk about this because the nurses and the police officers out there don't understand this.
Yeah.
It's like it could almost be empowering or discriminating depending on the thing, but you'll never get like, they'll never tell you, oh, we're not going to do this because you're a full figured black woman, but they'll be like, ah, you're just not the look we're looking for. Uh-huh, uh-huh. But you can't do that at fucking Chick-fil-A. You know what I mean?
You better not.
Yeah. Right. So
not their pleasure.
It's a weird line that we're still playing that everyone else is not playing with their game. And, and we kind of almost take it for like, it's okay, but it's not. But in the view, it is, but everyone has to be really conscious about what they say and do. And like, I think it's been getting better.
Yeah.
Since I started touring and, but it's still there. It's still like this weird underlying factor. Do you ever feel like, is there a point when you feel, I mean, obviously Monet made you feel empowered. Is there anything that made you feel inadequate because of the opportunity that was put in front of you? And is it hard to shrug off, man? Like, as an old white dude, like, I have things that I can't shrug off, but I'm sure for you, it's like completely different.
I remember I was hired to do a music video it was an indie artist. They weren't even a major artist, but they wanted like an eclectic band. And I did the whole shoot, right? A whole day of shooting. And at the end of the day, the manager comes and they are livid. And they, you know, I'm in earshot. I can hear, this is not the kind of girl I was talking about, you know? And she, and like, they didn't put out the video with me in it. Like, they reshot it.
Shit.
Jeez.
I mean, a whole day of shooting. And the artist is cool with that, you know? And when the powers that be came, they were livid at who they picked for the girl.
Do you almost feel responsible for that at that point where you're like, oh, it's me. It's me.
I mean, I definitely cried, but I'm just like, I can't. I mean, I didn't hide who I was. I mean, thought I was hired because of who I was, you know, and to find out that. I mean, there's another time where I was a respected producer was putting together a band and they said they wanted women. That were starting want to make like a woman band, like a Mint Condition, right? And I go audition, and I'm asked to ghost play, and they hire a model they want me to help learn to play, and they want me to record the parts, but they want her to front it. And I was like, "Are you kidding me? Like,
hold on, yeah.
What?"
For some people who might not know what ghost play is, and I want to make sure I understand the context of this, so. They wanted you to be side stage playing while the person on stage was the
figure. They wanted me to play all the parts, record all the parts. They just didn't want my face to be there. They wanted her body and her face. They wanted a more racially ambiguous looking ethnic girl, you know?
There's that equal opportunity bullshit again where it's like, you can't say nothing.
But this is this producer saying, we want serious musicians. We wanted this to be a band. But they didn't really want it to be a band. They just wanted to look, you know. And I was out done. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, she doesn't even play. Like, she doesn't even play. She, like, but the look mattered more, you know. And I feel like, I don't know.
Here's my thought process.
There was an artist that I had to work with that I was never allowed to stand directly next to them because I was much taller than they were. And they thought him being a man, it was going to be emasculating. So I'm never standing directly next to him in pictures. I'm always, you know, because I was just too tall and I wasn't allowed to wear heels because I couldn't be any taller than what I already was. You know, there's, you know, a lot. I mean, I'm, like I said, I'll be 40 in March. Maybe I didn't say, but I'll be 40 in March. So like ageism Congrats. Is also a thing too, you know, like they want, you know, I actually thought that was going to put me out of the running with Lil Yachty. I was shocked when I got the call for that. But Yachty was also, I will give it to him. He's 26, right? He's young. I'm a good 13 years older than him. But he really respected us. Like, and it was all women, but he said he wanted musicians that could play and he's always been supported by strong women. And he feels like it was his job to also give opportunity to women that wouldn't get the opportunity otherwise, you know. And I just knew that my age was going to count me out. I just knew that I am not the cool dresser. You know, like, I'm not, full disclosure, I had very, like, I knew who, like, very little about Lil Yachty outside of him being in a Sprite commercial. You know, like, I you know, it's just, I don't.
That's so good.
When I found out about it, I was like, I didn't think I was going to be cool enough for that gig, you know? And so it's like to get the gig, it was great, you know, but he just allowed us to be who we were as people. So it was a blessing. And just, you know, it was a blessing. I just totally counted it out before I even got the gig. I was like, there's no way. Like, there's no, I mean, Yachty has like 8,000 cool pairs of sneakers. And I think I have like these highlighter Adidas that I feel like are my cool shoes. And they are my one pair of cool sneakers.
I'm kind of glad this came up because I'm teaching a class at Webster University here as professional development for film and media and audio students that are going out into the field. And even me as being behind the scenes, like a lot of things you said, if I would have been in an earshot of that, I don't know how I would have handled it because I wouldn't have taken too kindly to it. And I talked to my students about it today, actually. And I'm like, sometimes you just got to shut your mouth and see if someone's going to have your back. Like sometimes you can't say, hey, that's not cool. That's not appropriate. That's like personal. But if hopefully somebody has your back and will speak up for you, and that'll allow you to kind of have a voice. Because I think, you know, in this industry, if you go at it alone, you might not get the gig.
Oh yeah.
And we're talking back to where you spoke on it's who you are. Mm-hmm. And if you keep speaking up about that, it might tarnish. Difficult. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're going to be difficult. But dang, dude, that I've been in the area of poor situations where things got either racial or sexual. And I, in my younger days, I just lost it. And I was like, no, but now I can like approach it better and like determine whether it's like something that we have to deal with or that's not what we have to deal with.
Yeah.
And it's so weird trying to explain that to people that work at normal jobs. I hate to say it, at a normal everyday job, it's like they don't have to do that. They go to the HR and that person like,
oh yeah, right,
has to watch some videos. Has to watch some videos and
right,
fill out some forms. Like that doesn't go down in our business. Mm-mm. And it's like every man for themselves, every woman for themselves. And hopefully, like you said about Yachty, at least you have the support of a person in a position that can have a voice for you when you probably should just shush.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so annoying. It's so annoying.
So speaking of that vein, you took a departure in your career or a left turn or whatever in 2019.
Yeah.
I like how so on your website you said you wanted to evolve on a new path of leadership, and you were hired as the music director at Decatur City Church, which is part of North Point, which is Andy Stanley, right?
Yes.
You were the first African American and first woman to hold this position.
Yes.
And there's obviously a lot to unpack right there. But I want to first touch on you wanted a new path in leadership, and then we can talk about some of the other stuff there. So what drove you into that mindset?
Just thinking about my career and like where I wanted to head, and like so, like definitely like music direction is like was the next step, and I just when the opportunity came, I was like, oh, because the production levels in this church are high, high,
yeah,
and
sure.
I was like, man, if I could, and I'd been like a contract musician within that network for a little bit, and I was like, if I could, if I could just start there, hopefully I could parlay that back into like back into the tour world, or like my dream gig would be like to be like the house band director for like a late night show. Like that would be like,
oh, okay,
dream, like cool.
Let's call Dietrich up and see if he needs some help up there at Whistler Love Myers. And
we got hookups at 30 Rock, we all know him.
That would be like the dream 9 to 5, I don't know, but in order to get there, I just needed some experience as a music director. And when that came, when it came to me, I was just like, okay, let's go. Like it was kind of presented to me. Like I remember when I was when the music director at the time was quitting, and I remember his boss, the director, programming director, like sent an email out to all contractors saying, hey, if anybody be interested, reach out. And I remember seeing the email and be like, oh yeah, probably not, like I don't have enough experience for that. So when I was personally invited to apply, I was like, oh, okay, let's see. And I just thought they were just doing the the PC thing, like, oh, let's just and I figured I'd just apply because it would look good, and I didn't actually think I would get it. And when I got it, I was like, oh, okay, let's go. So, yeah, but I really wanted that experience. I really wanted that experience. And I was hoping that would help me, like, prepare me for what might come in the future.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that stood out to me is, yes, it's a big deal being the first African-American, at least in that church, doing that. It's actually more the woman side of it is actually what stuck out to me, because again, Atlanta's the South, right? So being a first time American in a church or anything is maybe not the biggest of a deal, the non-denominational Southern Baptist-ish Christian world of the South, I grew up in that environment, like women were not allowed in any form of leadership, it was only a male role thing or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, that's a barrier to have been broken of, what was probably a wrong thing to be pushed for so long. Right. So, while the people came to you and wanted you to try, was there any pushback that you felt at all from either congregation or other people, or what was that environment like?
So that church has 8 campuses. Andy Stanley is very popular.
Yep.
It's a very big church. The campus that I work, Decatur City, that campus is in a neighborhood, is in Decatur, which, as far as the greater Atlanta area. Decatur is probably one of the more progressive size of town. So the main church is in Alpharetta, which is, not as diverse, I would say.
Affluent.
A little more like
not college. Diverse.
It's all good. It's all good. Yeah.
It's cool. I'm used to it.
So it made sense for that campus to be the first campus to extend a job like that to a person of color, to a woman, and I can't say that I'm not the first woman in leadership in the church, but in the music department.
Sure, sure, sure.
Yes. Like that was, I was the first, and there was a lot of, I felt pushback. Okay. And it's a lot of reasons why I felt pushback from some of the other campuses, from some of the other musicians in the campus that, you know, maybe didn't know who I was, like, you know, and then some who thought I didn't belong because I didn't come from that world. Mm. Here, who is a secular world musician coming into our space, and she gets a leadership role, you know, like, that's, I felt a lot of pushback in from that, in, you know, like, who are, you don't, you know, and I had only been playing in that network for a couple of years, you know.
You're not one guys, of us. You're not one of us.
I mean, I wasn't one of them, but I didn't, you know, it's not my fault.
But look, like, my comeback would be to that is like, look how much you emulate the secular world. Like, right. You guys want that.
That's exactly. You want this experience. You want that. But so maybe there was a little bit of jealousy there too. You know, and it wasn't from everyone. Yeah,
that's a good expression. Envy.
Yeah, but, you know, and at the time when I got the job, I was still working with Janelle. So, like, one of the stipulations I had was I had to finish out my contract year with her. So we did, which meant I had to go to Coachella. We did Coachella that year. I had to go to the Grammys. We did the Grammys that year. Like, I had to go finish small out hands, our European tour. Like, we did Macho Jazz Festival. Like, I was like, yeah, I have to finish those out. So here I am, you know, they're watching, I'm at church on with you on Sunday, and then on Tuesday, I'm, you know, it was a lot of ruffled feathers at the beginning. but I can't be worried about that at this point in my life. I'm used to ruffled feathers. So.
Fast forward, now you're with Little Yachty, and you have to go back to church.
Oh my gosh, yeah, well, I don't work there anymore, but like, not on staff, but if I were, oh my gosh, there would have been a picket. There would have been a lot of issues.
Got some splaining to do.
What did you learn about yourself in that pursuit of looking for a leadership role and having to change just being the, I don't, I'm not degrading like being a band member, but like, you're a support person on stage, right? You're just a piece of the thing, as opposed to now you're responsible for the thing. You are, you know, you're responsible for people, and you're responsible for delivery and presence and all these things, not just for yourself. You know, like, what did that do for you?
Man, like, definitely what I learned most is about is the people management. That's the thing I didn't expect. I was like, I'm a musician. Music is fun for me. This is easy. I love arranging. Like, that's, I just thought, no, the job. And so, like, for example, in this network, the band is never the same every week. Like, it's different musicians every week, you know? And so I'm having to put together people, figure out personalities, who works best with who can bring out who, you know, and this is every week, every Sunday, you know, where it's a different set with different people. And then having to manage, like, I used to be one of you and now I'm your boss. And so now that was also like difficult, like person, you know, like making, like learning how to keep my feelings out of it, or like learning how to be okay with not being friends with you anymore because I have to tell you what to do now. You know, like, that was, you know, as a person who's a people pleaser and who loves people to love you, you know, like, having, you know, to now be like, I have to be in charge of you right now. I can't play with you in the green room anymore. Like, I have to make sure that you're on time now. You know, like, that was difficult. I mean, learning Ableton was difficult for me. but it was something I really, that's the main thing I really wanted to learn, was like learning how to build tracks and stuff. I really wanted to get that skill set underneath my belt. And so that really helped a lot there. But yeah, I think out of anything, the music part to me is the easiest part to me, because that's what I love to do. It was just learning how to manage people and actually learning how to be in a corporate type of setting again, after being like so free spirited for so many years, having to like get used to going to meetings again and like having to answer to someone outside of myself again.
I mean, because look, right, wrong, or indifferent, and not to dig into this portion of it, but I mean, churches are a business, right?
Yes.
I mean, you know, whether you're a believer or outside, doesn't matter. Churches are a business, right? And so there are rules. There are, here's what we want to look like. Here's what we want to sound like.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, I know, like, you know, I worked in, you know, mixing in a non-denominational church, right? And like, we would literally have meetings of like, what does Valley Point sound like? What is the sonic signature of this church?
Yes.
Did you ever find yourself at a crossroads of like the church, and it doesn't have to be this church, right? Because this is, I'm not, and anything I'm saying has nothing to do with Andy Stanley or his church, right? This is church culture, things that happen.
Right.
But having to be like ever at odds with what you felt was right or wanted to do versus like, nope, I have to now push this, not, I don't want to call it an agenda, but like this experience that I'm being told to, this is the experience we have to deliver, even if I feel that this is musically or the better, I don't know, like, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, that's something you had to learn to squash, right? Like your person, like, no, it's true. Like, and while I was at that campus, like, we had a specific person that it was like a, I forget the, so we're, it's something my words are failing me right now, but it was basically like a prototype person. Like, this is the person that, you know, attends this church, and this is the kind of what they would want to hear. And this is what, like, we had to build and create around this idealistic person. And sometimes I understood it, sometimes I didn't. Sometimes I agreed with it. Most times in my heart, I didn't. But I, you know, like, I had to just kind of like learn how to take myself out of it and just do the job that I was hired to do, which I think is important, because everything can't be, you know, like, you know, it's not always about me and what I think, you know, like, and it's part of learning how to work on a team. It's part of learning how to work with different types of people, which are all valuable skill sets that I could take anywhere, you know, like, you know, I might one day work with an artist, and just because I'm the MD doesn't mean I have full control over everything. I have to take what the artist, you know, what they believe, and I have to make it work according to their vision. You know, my vision doesn't matter as much as the artist. So let's just replace artists with church. Like, my vision doesn't, like, I'm hired by this church to do this job. So
I noticed at my church too, it's the same thing. I work at an inner city church here, a pretty large one in St. Louis. And a lot of the musicians are hired in. The MD kind of has to take a path of, it's not about you, it's about the vertical and not the horizontal.
Yes.
And you almost lose your individuality, not as a player, but how you present the music. Mm-hmm. And now I understand, after being there for 5 years, it's about, let's just be honest, it's about the spirit. Like, the spirit takes you where it's going to go. And I think that's an interesting approach to musicians that are trained, because they're not used to taking that approach. Like, it's more stylistic or artistic, but church is more of a, it's still that, but it's called spiritual. and there's lines that are drawn like that. It's pretty cool. What I want to talk about is, all of a sudden, church is done and you are in a live band for a hip hop artist named Lil Yachty. Lil Yachty. How is that experience? So, one, your Ableton stuff, you guys are always playing the tracks, and we talked off air before we started recording how it was like a Pink Floyd experience now.
Yes.
And how he wanted to take the music a different direction, got a live band. How was that for you?
One, I thought it was really cool, like, witnessing his excitement with music and like his this new like, I feel like it was like a new door in his artistry for Eve, like what watching him be all, like, he's discovering all this stuff, and it's so cool to like watch that, because I just remember how music made, you know, like, made me feel when I was discovering it. So like, to see his excitement with that, and then seeing how passionate he was, like, he was there from the first day of rehearsals up until the very first show. So like, we started rehearsing at the end of January. Our first show with his new music was like first week of March. And from day one of rehearsals, he was there. Like, I've never really rehearsed the artist from the beginning. He was there making sure that he had his producers that work with him on the album there every day, making sure that the tones are right, that the parts are right. Like, he really wanted it to feel like the music. And so that was really encouraging for me, because I mean, personally, I don't vibe. I feel like I don't vibe a lot with most current music. Like, I'm very old school in my heart. Like, I, you know, and like, new music is so, I don't know, it doesn't really interest my ear as much. But this I felt like was right in my alley. I'm like, oh, it's like real parts, it's real bass lines, it's like, you know, and to see him be so serious about it and like interested in like the creation, like it was inspiring to, I don't know, I felt very inspired. And I was like, oh, look, I mean, I made me feel a little old. I was like, look at his kid, like he gets it, you know.
is he influenced by Tyler the Creator at all? I mean,
yeah, they're friends. They're very close friends, and I know that he referred to him a lot. Got a lot of opinion from him. Like Tyler was able to speak into his show. Like, you know, even we did mostly festivals and stuff until his tour, and I know that Tyler saw one of the festival shows and encouraged him, you know, to make some changes for his tour that would, you know, help the show like kind of evolve.
Yeah, everything you said reminded me of, we talked to 5-1. He was like a tour accountant or whatever out with Tyler the Creator, and same thing. Tyler would come up to the show like, in rehearsals. He's like, oh, that's not. I want it to be Pantone 202. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. He's that level of creative in his art, and it's an experience. You know, that type of thing. So that like it sounded like almost the same headspace than
Yadi was very intentional. Even all his auto-tunes had to be specific. They needed to be dialed just like they were per song. It was really cool. If you haven't had a chance to go listen to it, it's a really eclectic album. Like it's him. It's very much Lil Yachty, but like I thought it was really cool how he brought himself to that style of music and kind of I don't know. It was really interesting.
So the correlation I saw between, you know, a Tyler Creator and Lil Yachty is that, like, you know, like I, you know, when I saw you work with Lil Yachty, I saw you were out on tour with him. I was like, I'm gonna go listen to him. I'm like, I don't get this art, right? I had the same feeling. Yes, I am old. But also I have a 15-year-old daughter too, right? So I do my best to try to relate to the stuff that she listens to. Like she's into Lil Uzi Vert and Boogie with a Hoodie and stuff like that, right? And and so it's like I'll bump that in the car, right? You know, and I may not love it, but like, you know, I just do my best to relate, right? So I remember the first time, like, I was like, okay, let me dig into Tyler Creator. I'm listening to it, I'm like, I don't get this, I don't understand it, right? So completely. And then when I experienced his show and I saw the art and everything that came together, it was like, I get this. And then I could go back and I could listen to the albums and enjoy it. So did you have any similar experience of like maybe hearing, like you said, you didn't really know who Lil Yachty was, you didn't know much of his stuff, but then now you experience his live show, what he's curating with it, that live connection with his music is radically different than just having consumed it on Spotify or wherever.
No, it's true. And also, he is a beast of a live performer. Like, and watching his interaction with his fans, it's insane. And like he really like for this tour he footed a lot of the bill himself. Like he really wanted to have like an immersive experience. So like he had this huge screen and he had all of this artwork done, and he hadn't toured in what, 5 years, maybe 7 years, and he said he really wanted to give an experience to his fans. Like, you know, he wanted them to have an experience. And so, like, watching his passion for his, he really does love his fans and he appreciates them. And watching how he really wanted to also immerse them in this new world that he's created was inspiring. Inspiring. You know, I hadn't been on the road since 2019. So like getting back out there with him, like I felt like it was, you know, my first time back, just like he felt like it was his first time back. And like, I don't know. It was encouraging, you know, to see him be courageous and stepping outside of his norm. Cause his new music is not like to his old music. And he did embrace all of his music on tour. Like, you know, he started out with the new album, had a middle set with a DJ to kind of incorporate his old music that his fans loved, and then ended with the new album again. So it was like a full circle moment for him. And watching
Tyler did a similar thing. Like he had a B stage. So like he did his current album all on the main stage. And it's like, all right, I'm going to go over here. I'm going to do this thing over here. We're going to go old school for a minute. And like he did his more like hardcore, you know, stuff out there, you know, and then went back to the stage and, you know, finished out his current stuff. So. Yeah,
I think it's crazy because I'm old and remember how people used to write off DJs and people wrote off electronic music, especially musicians. And then that kind of flooded into the general public where they didn't think that they had more to offer than what you heard on the record. And I like how you explained it, that he's a creative.
Yes.
You didn't say, oh, Lil Yachty, the rapper or whatever. Like, I think that is how this music is going to progress past people thinking that it's just a track and a dude with a mic. And and the creative aspect of these people isn't like most of these people just bang it in the car. Like they don't get to experience a true rap show, hip hop. I don't know. I still have a problem calling it hip hop because I'm from the 80s and like I got Run DMC and Public Enemy on my wall right now. Yeah. And some of the five elements aren't quite there, if you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
but I think the creative point of those artists is going to be more prevalent. And I'm glad you got to experience that because I remember when Lil Wayne went out and took a full band. People didn't receive it very well.
Yeah.
But now it's almost like they want that. And and artists like Tyler and Lil Yachty and even, holy cow, like the Drake tour right now is blowing up. Like those artists are, that's what they are. They're not, they're not just rappers from Brooklyn and they're not standing at parties with a microphone with the DJ. Like they have a creative vision for where their music is going. It's it's not about a thing. And to be a part of that, like you're in the band. Like
and his first band at that, like, you know, like it was just great. I will be great. I'm forever grateful to have been part of his first, like a first for him and part of like creating beauty and like art with him in a time where he felt most vulnerable, because this was a vulnerable time for him. That this album was a vulnerable album for him. He did it in the pandemic, you know, when we were all shut down. He decided to reinvent himself and like try something new, and he put it out against, I think probably, I'm pretty certain he probably got pushed back from his label because it wasn't his typical, you know, and he had to prove to them and to everyone that this is what he wanted to do and that it was going to be successful. And I'm really proud of him for that, and I'm honored to have been a part of that journey with him. And, you know, he's forever evolving and changing. He, like he says himself, he gets bored easily, so, like, he likes to go to the next thing. So he's, you know, I know he's working on something new with James Blake right now, and so, you know, I think this album was what it was.
Well, you know, vulnerable, but not as vulnerable as Andre 3000.
No, let's not, please.
Sorry. Respect. Anyway,
maybe in the future, we'll see Lil Yachty with the kazoo. Who knows? But you know.
Oh man! All right.
This is a song I wrote in a high rise in New York that I wanted to fall asleep to.
All right, I want to reminisce on an experience that Tasia, you and I shared. All right. So to set the stage, literally and figuratively, so for those who don't know, at the end of tours, there are pranks typically that happen on the last night of a tour. The audience is oblivious to this. And sometimes the pranks, the audience is not a part of it. Don't know. Things just happen. And maybe this has gone away. I haven't toured in 14 years. So maybe pranks, end of tour pranks have gone away. I'm not sure. But it was a thing when I was touring. And so I was mixing monitors for the headline act, which was Anthony Hamilton on this tour. And then Music Soul Child was the support act, and Tasia was out there. And so you all had an all-female band. You had two dancers. And there was a middle part of the show where, like, you know, music takes his break. He goes off stage and he, you know, you rest up or whatever. And, like, there's some choreography dance and you guys are jamming and whatever you guys are doing. I thought it would be hilarious. Actually, I thought it'd be hilarious to come out there and like dance with y'all on the last night. But I was like, nah, I gotta do more than just come out there and dance with you guys. I was like, I gotta take it to the next level. We're touring theaters, and I may or may not have come across a wig in a dressing room while we were in Detroit. And I was like, when can I use this? So I may have commandeered a wig from a theater in Detroit somewhere. And then like we're coming up with another tour, and I was like, I gotta go full out. So like on day off, I went to Walmart and I got this bright yellow skirt, and I got this blue shirt, I got these sunglasses, and I had it all planned out. Like the whole tour, except for music, knew that I was coming out on the stage, right? Because like people had cameras ready and everything. So I come out on the stage. I'm out there for like 5 seconds at best. I started doing the Macarena because that's all the only dance this white boy knew how to do at the time. And
you could do the worm. I've seen you.
I could do that now. I could do that then, actually. Pretty Ricky actually taught me how to do the worm. But anyway, that's a whole different story.
Oh, that's another box of worms.
And meanwhile, everyone thought it was hilarious, minus music's security guy who didn't recognize me. He didn't recognize my hairy legs under the skirt or my goatee or anything like that. He comes running out on stage, like basically practically picks me up and like drags me off the side of the stage. And I was barely out there for not even a minute. So he did his job. I'll give him that. Music was pissed. His manager was pissed. And our tour manager, Bill Reeves at the time, was like, he's like, yeah, it was funny. He was like, you got to apologize, right? And then, like, to make it even, like, I came out during Anthony Hamilton's set, did the exact same thing, so it wasn't just punk and music. But I thought it was freaking hilarious. I think you guys were all busted up laughing on stage, so.
Yeah, but music, I mean, it was, and his security was his brother at the time, Reed. Yeah, Reed was, yeah. We thought it was hilarious. I loved it last, so I thought it was great.
Oh man, it was funny. So like I dug up some pictures, I sent them to Tasia and I sent them to Kyle. I'll post them on like our socials and stuff once this thing comes out, just because they're like crappy old pictures. So like they're like cell phone pictures, so like they're all pixelated, but you can still get the vibe. It was fun though. So I was like, and you know what's funny is, so when I was thinking about like having you on Tasia and stuff, I was like, I kid you not, like, and I remembered this once I saw you at Janelle Monáe, like, you're the only one that I actually remember from that band. Like, just like, you have a very electric personality. And like, obviously the strings help too with the colorfulness, right? Like that sticks out. And so I've enjoyed like kind of like, you know, watching your career and see you out there. I'm like that would be fun to like experience and work together. So it was cool. We got to do that one night together at, you know, with Janelle Monáe. So,
yeah. Well, I was excited that you remembered me. So like, thank you so much. Like it means a lot to me that you remember and that, you know, you're kind to me, you know, and you mentioned talking to Kev, like, you know, that wasn't y'all's first rodeo, but like, I never felt it. Like treated like less than, you know, or like, oh, she doesn't know what she's doing. Or I probably didn't know what I was doing a lot of time, you know, like, but, you know, it was fun. I just have fun, happy memories of that. And you were one of fun, happy memories. I enjoyed meeting you then. And like, I enjoyed being on the road with you all. And so like, I'm honored that you remember me even now. So like, thank you. Like, it means a lot.
I got two questions. I don't know, Kyle, do you have any questions? I have two questions to end this out with, but I'm if you had any other questions, Kyle, before I end it out with two questions.
Do it.
All right. So the first one would be, having spent, you know, a majority of your life at this point, you know, being a, you know, professional musician, what's something you know now that you wish you knew when you first started?
Definitely to save my money.
Amen.
Yes.
Really and truly, I wish I really wish I just understood that I should pace myself and that I should plan for a rainy day or a rainy pandemic. Like,
oof, that's famous. Some truth right there. Jeez,
famous.
Oh, man. All right, and Tasia, if you could define your legacy, how you'd want to be known, how would you define that?
That was a nice question. I like that. I would like to be known as someone who, I want people to remember that I truly respected their music and I wanted to play it from my heart. And like, I want every artist I work with to always feel like I brought passion to their stage and joy and honor and respect. Like I want, yeah, that means a lot to me because as an artist, I would want to feel the same way. And anytime I get an opportunity to play, it really is a blessing. Like, it really does feel like a blessing to me. And if, like we talked earlier, like, you know, I'm always just like, oh, I get to do this, I get paid. Like, you know, like, I never want to lose that feeling. And like, anytime, even if, whether it's a local gig for 20 people, or, I mean, I don't think I've ever played for 20 million, but let's say one day I get there, right? Like, I never want to lose this, that feeling, like that, like honor that I get to do this and I get to bring this experience to others. And I always like, yeah, I want people, if they look back on my career, I want them to feel proud that they had me work with them and proud that I could bring that kind of, you know, respect and passion to their show, to their music. Like, I hope that, you know, when I'm not in the room, people be like, yeah, I want her around because she made me feel good and she made my music feel good.
I think it's really fun that we got to share just a portion of your story, because I really hope that this inspires, you know, our listeners, and it's definitely inspired me, because we heard a little bit about your trials and tribulations through it, and I feel like your positivity is going to push you to just keep doing this and be great at it. So I'm just really excited that we got to share your story. This is why we do it. And I know it's just a portion and it's your professional life and stuff like that, but it really put a lot of things together for me. One, even when we've started out and you said you were the only musical person in your family, I was that kid too. Yeah. And I still can't explain that drive, but to hear someone else talk about it the way that you did was enlightening to me, to know that it's okay.
Oh.
So thank you.
Thank you. No, you all even inviting me to be here today was inspiring for me. It made me feel like somebody wants to talk to me. You know, like, because hey. Sometimes you feel in a rut, you know, or you feel like it's the beginning of the year for me. I'm just trying to figure out what my year is going to look like. And so this, I was like, it felt very validating. So thank you. Thank you all for having me on. You know, like, it made me feel really good. So, like, thank you.
Chris and I come across so many interesting people that don't have a platform to, like, talk about it, you know? And I think it's interesting because, like I said, we find little bits and pieces throughout everybody's stories that matches a lot of us out there. And yes, that's important to know that it's okay. It's all okay. We have ups and downs. There's a struggle. There's a success. And like you said, I even talked to my class about that today. I was like, saving money, doing your taxes, being correct. This entertainment business thing doesn't work like everybody else's normal job.
Right.
You know, and it's important that we talk about it. And at least someone will hear that and go, you know what? I probably should set up a little account or, yes. and that's perfect. You affected one person, and that person will be like, yo, I listened to this thing. And like, she went through the same thing and her goal was to like save for the future, because like you said, you never know when you're just going to be sitting around. Thanks, COVID.
Right. Thanks. None of us could have prepared for that. That's crazy.
But thank you so much. Appreciate you.
Cool.